I feel the need for a podcast exploring the films and career of Tom Cruise. Welcome to Cruise Views! Was that loud enough? Could you hear that? Okay, cool.
If you can maintain that volume for the whole episode, that'd be really good.
Hello, and welcome to Cruise Views, the podcast where we express the views we've accrued about Tom Cruise from the views we've perused of his movies. Do you like that? That's new.
That's very good. Yeah.
It's very good.
We're trying to find out how he became our last proper movie star by watching every film he's been in chronological order, and you join us as we reach 2005 and the sci-fi blockbuster War of the Worlds. I'm Adam Scott Glasspool. I'm joined, as always, by my very own alien life form that buckles at the merest hint of a cold. It's Tom Ashford.
Hi, everyone.
And we're also joined, in his second appearance, host of the podcast How to Survive, Chris Morris.
Hello. How's it going?
Hi, Chris. Yeah, good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yeah, yeah. I'm doing good. Looking forward to talking about a good film.
Okay, cool. That's really enticed the audience. That's excellent. Well, I mean, you've joined us for Rain Man, so we have a pretty good idea of how you feel about Mr. Cruise and his work. And we actually ended up talking about Spielberg on that episode, because he was gonna direct Rain Man at one point, so we did a little bit, right, of Spielberg chat. Mm-hmm. Is that, like, why did you pick War of the Worlds? Were you just, you had a little taste of Spielberg and wanted to talk about him some more, or?
Well, I have very fond memories of War of the Worlds from childhood, because I watched it at the time, and I would have been, 14, 15? And also, it's a film that I know very well, having covered it on How to Survive, my horror movie podcast that I do with my friend Joe. But I think it's just a great, as I'm sure we'll discuss, it's kind of like an archetypical Tom Cruise midlife film, I think.
I think you're going to say midlife crisis.
Well, there's an element of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ray is definitely, he's going through some stuff. Let's put it that way.
He's going through some stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Some of that stuff is aliens.
Mm. I have to say as well that you said my views on Tom Cruise are well established, which is probably true from the Rain Man episode. But I saw a video recently that made me think of the two of you and this podcast. And I'm not sure whether or not you've seen... So just to recap, I'm pretty sure what I would have said about Tom Cruise before is that he's essentially a maniac. And like every single thing he does is both incredibly impressive and also like dangerous to the point of psychopathy and like completely unnecessary. And to that end, have you seen the video of him standing on a plane to announce the title of Mission Impossible or something like that, isn't it?
He's introducing the screening of Top Gun Maverick.
That's it,
like some event.
CinemaCon or something like that.
And the one where he screams, "See you at the movies!" And then there's a huge barrel roll away from the camera. Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. It's demented.
The orchestration of that, for the sake of something that could easily have been him sat in front of a laptop.
Yeah, I know.
Again, on the one hand, it's very impressive. I wouldn't want to do that. And the level of artistry that's gone into it is, you know, undeniable. But on the other hand, someone needs to have a word with him.
he is an insane man.
If you're up there.
Yeah, while you're up there. Yeah. While you're up there. Because they are filming, isn't that something to do with Dead Reckoning Part 1 or Part 2. I don't know which one the biplanes will appear.
Well, I really hope there is no Part 2. I hope it's just Dead Reckoning Part 1 and then a different name.
Yeah. I hope the biplanes are absolutely nothing to do with it. It's just Tom Cruise it's just gone mad again.
You think that whole week of filming that they spent on the biplanes was just for that, for the introduction to Top Gun Maverick?
And then
they'll put
out a behind the scenes video, and it will turn out that the camera is mounted on the side of a F-15 that's been flown like remotely by Tom Cruise somehow as well. And like,
he's
flying
the plane at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're actually going to touch on this being the beginning of the insane Cruise era. This is kind of the point at which his personal life starts to bleed into the movies, because it hasn't yet really. There's been rumblings and stuff going on in the background that me and Tom have kind of covered. But the press tour for War of the Worlds is absolute unbridled insanity on a number of levels, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
I've been waiting for this since we started the podcast.
I don't know anything about this, so I can't wait.
We might not have prepped you specifically for what we're going to talk about, but I guarantee you know about it. It's one of the most famous Tom Cruise sort of things. But
I think I do know what it is.
Yeah, you do. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Tom, fill us in on War of the Worlds.
Well, it was released on the 29th of June 2005 in the US, and we got it a whole whopping, like, few days later on the 1st of July.
Ooh.
So that's exciting. I don't know if you've heard of the director, guys, but Steven Spielberg.
Who is that?
He's made a couple of films.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Did we talk a lot about Spielberg for Minority Report?
Yeah, we spent a good like half an hour covering that, and I think we should do that again for Chris's sake.
Okay. Yeah, we should. Well, Chris, what's kind of your thoughts on... what are your thoughts on Steven Spielberg, Chris?
Imagine if I was just like, oh, he's a talentless hack, and like... he'll never amount to anything. No, he's like, he's incredible, obviously. He's probably the greatest populist cinema filmmaker that there has ever been. And, you know, every single... I think, you know, the quality of his individual films might kind of, you know, ebb and flow a little bit. But I think there are a few filmmakers who you can watch a scene and instantly... know that you're watching a one of their films. Someone like Wes Anderson, for example, you can probably spot his films from a mile off. I think you can do that with Spielberg in a more subtle way, but I think he has like this overall kind of just general level of quality that is quite difficult to find among like filmmakers who mainly make kind of blockbusters or like mass entertainment vehicles. And I think if you go back to Jaws, say, all the hallmarks of his style are right there. Things like, you know, having kind of shots that start as a close-up of something and then pull back and it's a wide shot or a two shot and then it moves through a scene and all this kind of thing, and like the length of each shot being kind of like 10 times the length of someone like Paul Greengrass or whatever, is you know, there are certain hallmarks of his style which I think have just been there in his work the whole time. And it's quite rare for you to sit down to watch a Steven Spielberg film, I think, and not just feel like, right, here we go. We know we're going to have a good time here.
It's a safe pair of hands, isn't it?
Yeah.
I actually went to see Jaws at the cinema like a few days ago. And Tom, I think you've been quietly kind of doing Steven Spielberg's Alien trilogy, right?
I watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which I hadn't seen before. We mentioned in the Minority Report episode, which was very good. Just is very good. Then I saw E.T. in IMAX at the cinema, and
also very good.
I would describe it as more than very good, a step above very good. Yeah, insanely good film, obviously.
And this comes out at the point where his career has always kind of been split in two a little bit from sort of like the 90s onwards. I mean, 80s is just absolute blockbuster fest all the way through. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of splits in the 90s. And this is like a weird... It's interesting. You said like this is kind of a... What did you say? It was that kind of like a standard midlife Cruise kind of film.
Yeah. So, and apologies to anyone who might be listening to who has already heard me and my co-host talking about this film on my old podcast, because I am going to shamelessly recycle a lot of the stuff that we've already said.
Excellent.
But I think this is specifically with Tom Cruise. This is kind of like where he becomes. this kind of archetype action movie dad, and which is referred to by my co-host. Basically, you won't have heard the episode of the podcast, but my co-host for a section of the podcast at least was recovering from surgery to remove kidney stones and was under the influence of extremely strong painkilling medication. And in trying to explain what Tom Cruise's character is like in War of the Worlds, he described him as a Tom Cruise dad, which I think is like a very apt description of someone who is basically a useless father, but the only like redeeming quality of their character is that they love their children and will like run across a burning battlefield for them. And somehow that's, you know, supposed to redeem in the audience's eyes everything else that he does in the film. Another example might be someone like Liam Neeson's character in Taken, or, you know, any right. kind of generic action movie where, you know, Bruce Willis in the later Die Hard films is like,
sure, yeah,
rubbish yeah. dad, but will kill countless people to defend his family.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Although I can't think of another movie where Tom Cruise does it.
Yeah, perhaps not. I mean, how often does he play a father?
Oh, well, I mean, we're kind of dancing around the sort of point is that like most Steven Spielberg films have some kind of father thing. Yes. I think he might have some kind of issues with his dad in the past or something. That's my big Steven Spielberg take. How often does he play a father? I don't think he plays a father again for a long old time. Right?
Do you think that's reflective?
I don't know that much
his,
about Tom Cruise.
Is that reflective of his personal life, do you think?
I don't know. He's about to become a father for the first time biologically as well, because his kids before this were adopted. I don't know. I think this is a weird Spielberg movie, though. It's kind of like halfway between. Like, he has that thing where he does, in the same year, he does Jurassic Park and Schindler's List, right? And then he kind of alternates. He does like one huge blockbuster, one weird, dark drama or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like the first one where he's doing both at the same time.
Mm.
On this watch, I was reminded of how I should never put this on like a Friday night. Do you know what I mean? It's actually not that fun, this movie.
No.
It's kind of dark and it's kind of bleak. Which is a weird thing for Steven Spielberg to have done, I think. But then this is also, I think, his like it feels like a direct reaction to his previous movie, which is The Terminal, one of the most like saccharine sweet movies there is. But also this is his 9/11 movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be like the most out there. That's pretty World War territory,
take.
You know?
yeah, hot take.
But there's a lot of 9/11 imagery in this movie. And so it is weird and dark. And I forgot that it wasn't like a fun blockbuster. And I think I probably would have found it fun when I was like 15.
Mm.
I don't find it so much fun anymore.
It's not
I don't know why.
It's not a romp, is it? In the way that you might think of with Tom Cruise and Spielberg attached.
Yeah, exactly. When you think of Tom Cruise at the height of his blockbuster powers and Steven Spielberg at his blockbuster powers, like, you'd think you'd get something fun and kind of energetic and uplifting
in some ways. Like a better version
of
Independence Day.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Why doesn't Tom Cruise punch an alien, for example? Because you'd expect that. Mm-hmm. If you just saw the concept, you'd be like, well, Tom Cruise is going to go toe-to-toe with an alien or
yeah,
probably fly
absolutely.
A spaceship or something, you know?
He does get fair share of hero moments, though.
Of course.
He does. This is one of the films where he plays like such a jack of all trades. He's like the best at most things. But it does mean it's weird that the only two films that they've done are Minority Report and War of the Worlds. Two quite dark, weird, haunted sci-fi movies. I mean, they would have kept working together if not for all of the stuff that happened that we'll get onto later. But that's who directed it. It's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah,
it's Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg.
This is right around the time he made... Is this Spielberg's film just before he made Munich?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, because that is what I was expecting you to say when you were saying about it being like the one feat, what, you know, like one fun film and then one really dark drama. Because Munich is incredibly bleak. And there are scenes from that, particularly a scene on like a narrow boat, which is kind of like seared into my mind as just like an incredibly like just nasty and cold and horrible scene.
But Spielberg is, I think, playing like in that mode here. He's not having a good time. Like, something's wrong with Spielberg at this point, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of distress in this film, I think, in a way that you don't get with something, even with something like Jurassic Park, where, you know, ostensibly it's people being killed by monsters.
But it's fun.
Yeah.
Like, there's something fun about the monsters killing people in Jurassic Park. And there's something much more human about War of the Worlds. And maybe it is the proximity to one of the worst terrorist attacks that had ever happened in the US. You know?
Yeah.
And there's a very important story change that they make to War of the Worlds to kind of reflect that as well. And it's Spielberg not having a good time. He's not having a good time. He's a sad boy, I think. Right, like the reason that they made the second Indiana Jones movie so fucking dark is because both he and George Lucas were going through divorces at the same time. So they were like, right, we're going to have someone ripping out another man's heart and stuff like that. He's going to drink that child's blood. it's a real sad movie, this. I don't actually like... It's on the edge of something I think twice about putting on if I want to have a good time, you know. And it was just weird to be reminded of that because I've watched this fairly recently, and even then I forgot some of the. There are some similar to that scene in Munich, Chris. There are some images in this that are just seared into my brain and will be forever. And I'll point them out as we go through. I like Spielberg. Not to go on about Spielberg, I think he does kind of get left out of the conversation when people are going, "Oh, who are like some of the greatest directors of all time?" And people are talking about Scorsese and Paul Thomas Anderson, obviously Stanley Kubrick or whatever. I think Spielberg gets left out just because he's like an omnipresence kind of. He's just there, and you're just like, "Oh yeah, Spielberg." But I do think that means he gets left out of the conversation. He's an incredibly competent director, guys.
Incredibly competent. Yeah. What a flattering compliment. He'll really appreciate that, Adam.
Yeah, he will.
He knows how to. He knows which way to point a camera. Like,
yeah.
He does. Very rarely is the camera pointed in the wrong direction.
Yeah. 50 years of cinematic achievement, and then he's a competent director.
Yeah,
he's going to put that on the poster for The Fablemans, which is getting good reviews. I can't wait to see that. That's going to be an interesting one because he doesn't really do like personal movies in that way. There are all sorts of like personal touches in his movies, but to have done basically his own biopic is very interesting.
The story of how one boy became the world's most competent director.
Put it on the poster.
That's the tagline.
The world's most competent.
But you're right, though. Like, he is kind of... I think it's almost like he's so obvious.
Yeah,
he's
exactly.
He's so obviously brilliant that people forget about him. But he's one of these directors that even his bad films, I think, for the most part, are sort of three-star films. And so it's very difficult to kind of... I don't know. Yeah. Like, but then maybe like he only has kind of like a handful of five-star, this is, you know, Hall of Fame films as well. I don't know.
Oh, you say only a handful. I think there's probably around 10, I reckon, of like legendary films that he's made. And sometimes 10 is the number of films that a director makes in their lifetime, you know. His hit rate is actually pretty incredible. It's just that he's made so many films, you know.
Yeah.
Look, Spielberg. That's who directed this film.
Well, Adam, the writers are two people that I'm pretty sure we've seen before, Josh Friedman and David Koop. But Kep. Yeah, fine, whatever. But I can't remember who they are or where we saw them before, Adam. I'm hoping you do.
David Koop we've seen because we've talked about because he works with Spielberg a lot, and I can't remember what Tom Cruise stuff he would have written. But Friedman, I don't think so, man. I don't think we've talked about him, and nor do I recognise anything that he's written except... I mean, I recognise them, but I've not seen them. Chain Reaction, which is the Keanu Reeves, Morgan Freeman action thing, and The Black Dahlia, which I think you've seen.
Probably. I have seen The Black Dahlia. I saw it in the cinema.
And we've probably talked about because it was directed by somebody... Brian De Palma is who directed The Black Dahlia. Yeah, but David Koop, yeah, has written loads of stuff. I mean, he wrote Mission Impossible. He wrote Jurassic Park. He's written Spider-Man. You know, loads of stuff. Carlito's Way, stuff like Death Becomes Her. Yeah, he's kind of he's.
He's one of the world's most competent film writers, I think.
He really is. If you want something competently written, David Koop. Most of the time, anyway. Most of the time. There are also stuff like Ghost Town and Stir of Echoes in there as well.
It's adapted from a book by H.G. Wells, pretty obviously, I think, for most people.
Sure.
And music was
done by... Have you ever
read it? No, I haven't.
Feels like it would be your jam.
Yeah.
You know, as a sci-fi guy.
Yeah, really old sci-fi doesn't always call out to me. I've read a few old ones, like the Time Machine, stuff like that, but it's...
Sure.
I mean, obviously, it's really influential, but it's not exactly... They're not page-turners by today's standard. Put it that way.
Right, okay. Okay.
Like, Time Machine, he literally goes so far back, he just finds... Or so far forward, he finds some, like... proper like troll gremlin people and like that's weird and then goes home.
Okay, I don't think is that the story.
Yeah,
he goes and then goes home.
Pretty much. I think he gets lost for a bit, and then he gets back and then he goes home.
I've not read it. I'll take your word for it. Yeah, I'll take your word for it.
So no, I have not read that. But yeah, just on as always, honorable mention for music, John Williams, because it's Spielberg.
Yeah,
so
pretty fine in this, right?
It's
pretty anonymous.
It's mostly fine, yeah. It's not like stuff that you'd recognize on a compilation soundtrack or something, but it is right. Pretty cool when the big tripod rises up and there's like weird low throat singing.
Okay.
It's like, it's like that sort of thing. It's really like deep and gravelly and it's quite effective.
That's the problem, I guess, is that's the soundtrack is never going to be... or the score, I should say, is never going to be the element of the soundtrack that people remember from this film. It's always going to be the kind of like siren type noise, yeah, or like the klaxon thing that the tripod sounds whenever it's about to attack. Yeah. Which is, you know, very throat singy, but that, you know, noise is incredible. I remember being in the cinema and that, you know, that sound happening and being like, oh, fucking hell.
Yeah, it's a bit of a scary movie. This movie scared me.
Mm.
I watched it with headphones in and it was very scary.
Adam finds everything scary.
I think it's okay to watch a film about a billion people dying and find it scary. Like,
yeah, exactly. Thank you, Chris.
This must have one of the highest kill counts of a film.
Oh, yeah. That's got to be. Because doesn't he say at the end, like, it killed billions?
I'm pretty sure that's what someone says, isn't it?
It's at least a billion. A billion definitely gets thrown out somewhere. It's either a billion dead or a billion still alive.
Oh, it's got to be
a billion still alive.
I can imagine 5 billion people dying if the tripods appear across the entire planet.
I assume you covered it on your podcast, How to Survive. But how to survive this? I mean, I just wouldn't. I'd have shot myself in the head as soon as I saw the news, I reckon.
Yeah, I don't think with insight like that, I don't think we'll be rushing to have you on the podcast, I'll be honest.
That's my answer to most things. Is really quickly just shoot myself in the head.
If I saw Jason Voorhees, I'd shoot myself in the head immediately.
That's pretty much what I would do.
But I think in that we did say that actually, like, if a doctor came up to you and said you've got this incredibly deadly illness, but you've got a 6 in 7 chance of surviving it, that's not horrible. That's not horrible odds, is it? It, like, you know,
I'd probably ask, I suppose, right, say lead with the 6 and 7 rather than the 6 out of 7 rather than go, you've got this horrendously deadly illness. Most people survive.
But you can't go like, you can't go, I don't think if you're saying, oh, like tripod aliens came out of the ground and most people survived, that's not really like, doesn't feel like a apt description of the film, even though technically that is true. Like, yeah, you know.
I mean, the answer seems to be stay in a basement. That seems to be the answer to survive this movie,
I guess,
right?
Spoil the ending of the film, the thing about the podcast is that we're not necessarily always just talking about how to survive if you're the human beings in the film. And I know that we spent quite a long time talking about how we feel like the aliens should have done a bit more research before they invaded.
They're fucking idiots.
Yeah. Good point.
To be able to travel across the entire universe and then go, should we check the atmosphere? Should we check the
aliens from
Signs,
right?
Yeah, well, they...
It's the aliens from Signs who, allergic scared to water. Of water.
Yeah, but well, it's water again, isn't it, in this, essentially. And Morgan Freeman at the start says, like, they watched over us for... does he say thousands of years? And slowly and surely drew their plans against us. So, well, they didn't draw them very well, did they?
Imagine how, like, slowly they drew those plans. Like, they're there for like a million years going, the pencil would have been going so slowly over the paper for that plan, being like, what should we do?
Well, it's like they have invented interstellar travel, but haven't invented the microscope or any concept of like germs or anything like that. I don't know. This is, I mean, that's the ending of the film, everyone.
Yeah, spoilers for the ending of War of the Worlds.
Imagine if they turned up in like 2020. They just they turned up and they just been wiped out straight off. If a cold,
that would have been bad
get them,
timing. Yeah.
Imagine waiting a million years and then turning up during one of humanity's many pandemics.
Yeah.
Like, God damn it.
Yeah, coming out of the ground in the town square and going, where is everyone? I thought it's supposed to be like the middle of the town, isn't it? There's no one around.
Should we go over who's in it?
Yeah, I reckon Tom Cruise is in it.
Tom Cruise
is. That's why we've covered it.
Predictably, Tommy C is in it. We've got Dakota Fanning.
Yeah, so I guess a lot, you know, the talk around Dakota Fanning goes one of two ways usually for this movie. I think she's really good in it. I know a lot of people find her annoying. You know, I think she's doing what's asked of her. I think she's actually pretty good in it.
I think the character's annoying, and I think she's good in it.
Yeah, I think both things can be true, right? She is. It's annoying to be, or it's annoying and stressful to be in a car with a screaming 10-year-old, but also. Yeah. You know, that is, she is performing that, she's playing that role to perfection, isn't she?
Yeah. I think she's really good. I can't think of, is she still working?
I have no idea.
I looked this up because I asked myself the same question, and I think she has a production company with her sister, Elle Fanning.
Yeah.
And it's one of those Wikipedia things where you read it and it's like, oh, they announced a film in 2019 and it hasn't come out yet. And so okay, well, maybe it will come out, and I don't know. But her Fair. And her sister are going to be in it, and they play sisters. So,
I mean, I think she's good. She was also good in Man on Fire, although plays a very sort of similar role to this one. And then she's been in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I absolutely do not remember her being in.
No.
Absolutely no memory of that whatsoever. And she's in Ocean's 8, and I have no memory of that film at all. And I know I've seen it. And I could not tell you a single thing that happens in it.
I think there's a heist of some kind in it, isn't there?
Interesting. Okay. Interesting. that sounds like it might be right.
Weirdly, I think I saw a perfume advert yesterday which had Dakota Fanning in it. I might be wrong.
Interesting.
But
does Dakota Fanning have that kind of pull?
Well, so I think I was watching a popular streaming service, and I wonder if it's the algorithm, because I rented this film via Amazon, and I wonder if someone's gone, well, I tell you why he's watching this film. It's because of Dakota Fanning.
Because he loves Dakota Fanning. Because
he wants to smell like Dakota Fanning. The algorithm's
like
there going,
Fanning.
I've never been so sure of anything in my whole life. That this 31-year-old man wants to smell like 10-year-old Dakota Fanning in War of the Worlds, please.
Oh, God. Who else is in it? Oh, yep. Tim Robbins is in it.
I was going to say, moving swiftly on, we've got Tim Robbins.
Yeah.
He's a psycho.
Yeah.
A lovely reunited Tom Cruise and Tim Robbins, because, of course, he was in Top Gun briefly.
Was he? I don't remember him in it.
Proportionally, he's like second build in Top Gun, I think. which is like insane. And I think he's in it for about 30 seconds. Yeah.
I only think of Shawshank Redemption.
Hmm.
When I look at him, that's it.
See, I think of the guy from High Fidelity, the new boyfriend from High Fidelity, who's very into world music. That guy.
Yeah, that's
Tim Robbins for me. He is really hamming it up in this movie.
Yeah.
I very much enjoyed Tim Robbins in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we have some other people. That feels like, that's where the notable cast ends, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very... I mean, we should point out who plays Robbie.
Justin Chatwin.
Yes, thank you. And then that is kind of it. Though, there are four main people in it, because the film is very focused on just the family. It's Tom Cruise and his two children. I think that's the original title of the film, Tom Cruise and his two children.
It was autobiographical at that point.
Yeah, this happened to Tom Cruise. It was started like right after Minority Report. Spielberg and Cruise loved working with each other. They immediately wanted to get stuck in again and landed immediately on this as well. They both had big ideas for an early 2000s remake of War of the Worlds, or adaptation of War of the Worlds. They originally wanted J.J. Abrams to write it, but he was too busy with Lost, which is interesting, bearing in mind that the next Cruise movie is helmed by J.J. Abrams. That's a full J.J. Abrams thing. And it was shot on location in a bunch of places. Pretty standard production for a big blockbuster like this. They went to great lengths to keep as much of it secret as possible, so nobody knew what the plot was.
Yeah, God forbid anyone found out what the ending would be.
But so they focused on keeping like the design of the aliens like secret and stuff, and there was a lot of secrecy involved. There wasn't loads of clips that were released beforehand, but the production otherwise was pretty standard, apart from some Cruise shenanigans, which we'll get into later. The film opens at that sort of like cellular level, which is, I don't know, it looks like some kind of cell. I don't know. I'm not a scientist, and we get shots of the world. The world that will soon be at war, and a voiceover that's doing the opening of the book, and it's Morgan Freeman, who I think just got to do voiceovers at this point in American cinema.
Hmm.
He's only in at the beginning of the end, and if you wanted a voiceover, Morgan Freeman in 2005, that was your go-to guy. It's an easy day's work for him, really, isn't it? Reading out two paragraphs from a book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we go from that montage introducing us to Earth, I suppose, to a dock worker, Ray Ferrier, played by Tom Cruise, and he is the best crane guy in the world. He's the absolute best. Nobody else can move 20 containers in an hour. And you can't argue with 20 containers in 1 hour. That's an incredible work rate, guys, don't you think?
Well, that's one every 3 minutes, Adam.
It's insane. It's crazy.
That's the sort of thing where you think, actually, he's not really doing it right, is he?
He's cutting some corners.
Yeah.
But then he's also by the book. He's also very pro-union and will not, you know, do the overtime. He needs his allotted break. He's a real salt of the earth guy, and you can tell that because he's wearing a leather jacket and a hoodie at the same time.
Tom Cruise
is doing like a different walk than he usually does.
They go to extremely like painful lengths to make him as much a man of the people as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. A difficult thing to do at this point in Tom Cruise's career.
Yeah,
like global megastar Tom Cruise. But, you know, he does okay. Tom Cruise is, I think, somewhere between very good to fine in this movie, depending on the scene. I don't think it's a hugely, like, I don't think this film lives and dies on Tom Cruise's performance, you know?
No.
Yeah, I think you could replace him in the film, if I'm honest.
Yeah, for sure. But then he's bringing some stuff that is, that he's very good at. You know, kind of the darkness that he brings to it that we saw in Collateral. But he leaves his shift and he drives home to meet his ex-wife and his two kids, Robbie and Rachel. Robbie, Rachel and Ray at his home in New Jersey. He arrives late after a few minutes of debate over the children sharing a room and Robbie's homework assignment, which is due on Monday. The ex-wife and her new partner leave for Boston to visit her parents for the weekend. I think, look, this is kind of standard Spielberg stuff, but it does a pretty good job of setting up the dynamic between the family. Classic dad stuff. I mean, he's such a piece of shit, Tom Cruise, in this movie.
Yeah.
Very self-centered. It's an interesting use of Tom Cruise's, like, cocky vibe that he sometimes does, you know.
Yeah, he's very clearly a terrible father, and like you said, he's late. There's an extended thing about how there's no food in the house, no milk in the fridge. Yeah. He's got an engine on the kitchen table.
He's got an engine on the kitchen table.
Which, again, is like salt of the earth guy.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Doing loads of stuff with his hands, you know.
Yeah.
Real, like, stereotypically manly stuff, you know.
Yeah.
He's such a dad, which, again, is rammed home because the first thing he wants to do with his son is go out and play catch in the yard.
Yeah.
You know?
I think Tom Cruise is doing too much acting in these few scenes. And
yeah,
it's things like when he gets home and takes the bins out, he does it in a very passive aggressive manner, but it's like the most passive aggressive. Like, he's like basically like rolling his eyes and like shaking his head and like dragging the bin out. And it's like, yeah, we get it. There's also a shot which I don't know why, but it just completely winds me up when they go up to Robbie's room and for just absolutely no reason at all, Tom Cruise like spins the chair around and sits on it like reverse style. And like he makes,
he's a dad.
Right. But it's like, I think I always imagined the whole process of that decision being made where he goes like, right, Stephen, what I'm thinking, right, is that Ray, he's like annoyed. He's like pissed off. His wife's here. He's annoyed. He's divorced. He's annoyed. And he wants to sit down, but he can't just like sit down. He's got like sit down in like the most sullen, like sulky way. And Steven Spielberg's just like, yeah, fucking whatever, I don't care. Just like, just stand there. You haven't even got any lines. It's like the son and the mother are talking and you're just in the room. But it's like Tom Cruise has to like theatrically like swing this chair around and like sit on it and like sigh and huff and oh God, everything, the world's against me. I can't even buy a fucking pint of milk for my kids, but the world's against me. Like, oh
yeah,
God, I fucking hate hummus. Like, all this kind of shit. Like,
he's just a real soul of the earth guy, man. Yeah. What's hummus?
He's a man in need of a world-ending crisis, isn't he?
Like, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he'd just rather chow down on a cheeseburger, guys. you know, they're all kind of archetypes. Like, Robbie is the classic sulky teenage boy as well. And then Rachel is that sort of very wise young girl. Like, they have that very strained catch scene where Tom Cruise ends up like having a go at Robbie and breaking his own window and stuff. And then she's like, you won't reach him that way.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's very interesting. I think they have to go for quite broad, right? Mm. A lot of the performances in this are quite broad. Which I think mostly works. He goes to sleep and then wakes up to find Robbie has taken his car, and then he goes out to find him, but finds everyone looking at the strange weather pattern over the houses. And it really starts to feel like I really get a sense of the 9/11-ness of it all.
Mm.
The narrative portion of this movie starts with what is, I think, a pretty deliberate like shot of the New York skyline that doesn't have, it very notably doesn't have the Twin Towers in it, right? And then shots of people in New Jersey standing in their street or their back gardens watching what looks like plumes of smoke rising into the sky with that mixture of like fear and curiosity, kind of mirror scenes from that day, and then the lightning starts. And it's actually a really effective sequence, I think. Spielberg is like so good at things like this, like the build-up to the T-Rex sequence in Jurassic Park, and all the little the business with the electronics dying and the clocks stopping and the kind of that mixture of panic and curiosity. You get a sense of the nervousness, but also of like, well, I want to get in there and find out what's going on, and we follow Ray to check out what is going on. I think he finds Robbie and then sends him home, right? And then mm-hmm. travels on alone. He passes by the auto repair shop, which does two things, because the owner tells him that like the starter is burned out on a minivan that he's looking over, and Ray tells him to replace something because he's also the best at that. He mm-hmm. knows better than the mechanics who yeah. work at the auto shop,
yeah.
which made me think, why isn't he working at the auto shop? But it also sets up the fact that there's now going to be only one working vehicle at yeah. some point.
I also love that they introduce like a Dodge Challenger or equivalent. And then we just so Tom Cruise can drive it really fast home.
Yeah, power slide it around a corner.
Yeah, and then you think this is a vehicle that the main character is going to be using throughout this film. It's a cool car. It's a fast car. Never seen yeah. again.
Like, Tom Cruise would have gone on like a 6-week driving course for that one 5-second shot as well.
So he can tear around the corner. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. He ends up walking to the site where the lightning struck, I think is the point of where he's going. And then suddenly the ground under the hole like surges upward and everyone scatters and cars are being thrown everywhere. And a huge machine on three stilted legs bursts out of the hole and looks around. It's actually pretty scary. Mm. Like, it's pretty scary. And we get one of our only like wide shots as well when it stands up, so you get an idea of the scale. But for a lot of the movie, right, one of the things I really like about the movie actually is that the camera is like at human height,
yeah,
for a lot of it, which gives a real idea of, I mean, it's scary, guys, this movie is really scary.
But it's like, it's interesting, isn't it, because it's like the opposite of the thing that he does in Jaws, where you really don't see the shark until right at the end, whereas here it's like yeah. broad daylight. Here is the machine in full, right at the start.
I just saw Jaws at the cinema. As I said at the beginning, that jump scare the first time you see the shark properly still works.
Mm-hmm.
Still really good. Shark looks fake, by the way, but
yeah.
Jaws, good movie. Ray never kind of gets too far from the action, which, I mean, you know, if I hadn't shot myself in the head already, I'd have been out there pretty quickly, I think. But obviously, because we're doing it all from like his perspective, he needs to be close to kind of everything.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is one thing that I find quite a little bit contrived about the movie, is that in order to maintain the focus on this one guy has to have sort of like a pretty in-depth experience of everything that happens over the course of the 48 hours that the movie takes place.
Yeah, you know?
Even the beginning, when the first attack starts happening, when he's just running through the street and then through the like clothing shop or whatever, and like every single human being around him just gets lasered to dust.
He's so lucky.
And
yeah,
he'll just like stop just in time to not get lasered. Like, there's about 10 different moments in like 10 seconds where he should have died and doesn't because of plot.
Yeah, there's one shot where he's running behind a woman who gets like atomized, and the dust maintains the form of her face for like a second before Tom Cruise like runs through it. So he must have only been about a foot behind her. So yeah, like you said, he must have he was incredibly lucky.
But then, you know, if we had been following any other character. Short movie.
Yeah, true.
Like we're following,
and that's
Tom
the
Cruise's
genius of
because
Steven
he's
Spielberg,
very lucky.
Isn't it? Like that's what he brings to these films is that he knows not to focus on the people who get turned to dust in the first five minutes.
He was able to pick out the one character.
Well, he did actually he started 20 movies at the beginning, and they were all main characters, and he just went, "Who survives the longest here?" And then it just happened to be Tom Cruise, which was fortunate given his fee.
Yeah,
it's like Darren Brown's system for guessing horse races, right? For betting on horse races. Have you seen that one?
I think so.
No, okay. He makes a TV show where he like proves that he has a system for winning at the races, and we follow someone as they win every single race. But of course, he started like 40 different TV shows at the same time, and we're just seeing the edit of the one who happened to have won every single race. The people turning to ash, alarming, and obviously more 9/11 imagery. Mm-hmm. Like the way that everything gets covered in ash, the clothes floating through the sky is kind of haunting, and Cruise getting covered in that ash while running away from collapsing buildings feels very notable. Mm-hmm. Like being released in 2005. I really like it. Makes me very uncomfortable. It is in no way a fun or fresh, big blockbuster event movie.
I wonder if the analogy is more obvious now with hindsight than it might have been at the time, or if we were just maybe too young at the time to appreciate the analogy.
We were 100% too young. Like Spielberg went into this with... I am making a 9/11 movie, I think. Mm-hmm. Or at least kind of... I mean, he's talked about it being an anti-war movie in which, like, people don't pick up arms and fight. They're just terrified and they run. You know, like, there's a lot of glorification of, like, war in movies, I think. And especially from the point of view of the people who are, like, very heroic and will stand up to the enemy. And realistically... Again, if I've not shot myself in the head at the first hint of an invasion, I would be running. I'm not standing up for anybody. I'm keeping my family close, and I'm driving somewhere very far away, which I think is the correct impulse, but it makes for a very weird blockbuster movie, right? Because you're expecting Tom Cruise to be like, no, I want to get stuck in and deck the aliens, which he doesn't do. He's pretty like consistently scared.
They give him one moment to deck an alien, but he does it indirectly.
Yeah.
Mm. Probably decks quite a few.
It's an indirect decking. Yeah. I think he's very good at despondent sort of shock in this movie, Tom Cruise. Him returning home covered in ash and not talking to his children. And realizing that the ash, like he's covered in human remains and washing it off. Yeah, it's a good, I like that scene. Mm-hmm. As much as you can like something like that,
It's a great example of a scene where, because after he comes out of the bathroom, he says, we're leaving this house in 60 seconds. And one thing I think this film gets across really well about like panic is the feeling of having three conversations going at the same time and no one is actually talking to each other, because he just starts like listing off things that they need to pack. His son is saying like, what are you talking about? What happened? Tell me what happened. I want to know what happened. And his daughter is just like, what's going on, Dad? Why are you acting like this? And like all three of those characters are just like saying that at each other, like into the void, because no one is responding to them. But the way it's shot, obviously, like all handheld and kind of you're in the scene with them, and how kind of like kinetic it all is, that really does get across the feeling of like pure panic, I think, really well.
Yeah. And it happens in the next little scene as well, which is probably one of my favourite moments of the movie, which is that they go and get the minivan that is now working. It's basically the one working car on the street. And Cruz is like, he's talking to the mechanic, and he's saying, get in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to be kind of coy about it because he doesn't want to scare his kids. Mm-hmm. But the mechanic kind of thinks that he's joking. And he's like, get in the car. And he's like, no, come on. You need to get out of the car. And eventually, Ray has to go, if you don't get in this car, you are going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And Spielberg decides to focus on the reaction of Rachel
yes.
instead of anybody else. So you are immediate. It's a really effective moment that communicates like the seriousness and the panic of the situation that he's had to, in front of his child, resort to. If you don't do this thing, I promise you that you will die.
Mm-hmm.
Really effective. Really, really well done. Makes my stomach drop
mm-hmm.
every time I see it. And then they have to drive off while everything behind them is destroyed. The mechanic instantly dies. Mm-hmm. That prophecy is instantly fulfilled
yeah.
as he is vaporized by one of the tripods. That shot of them driving off is great, where it's kind of focused on the van, but behind them you see the bridge sort of collapse and stuff. It has the spectacle to it, the blockbuster spectacle, but also it is still intensely focused on that car. And that's followed by another insane shot that travels around the car as they discuss what's going on and where they're going to go as they all panic to varying degrees. And yeah, Chris, that thing you're talking about where they're all talking about different things at once, and Rachel's panicking, and they set up the thing about her being in her space and... Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise is shouting about where they might have come from, and they came from somewhere different. And Robbie goes, what, Europe?
Yeah.
And he goes, no, not like Europe.
Yeah.
It's maybe the one joke in the whole movie.
Yeah.
I will say that the sort of sequence where the freeway just comes down and just like decimates their home, like so instantly, is like, even though I've seen that sort of thing in like, dozens of apocalyptic, you know, 2012 sort of films and all that sort of thing. It's done so much more effectively because you've spent almost the entire film in that house, basically. Mm-hmm. Apart from him going round the corner, you know, it's that house, and it's wiped out so quickly. It's not like it's not like seeing New York skyline and Manhattan getting wiped out, and you're like, oh look, all those big recognizable buildings. It's just like, oh, my small little house is gone in an instant.
Well,
it's much more human. You can relate to the feeling of your own house being torn down.
I don't think you see any national landmarks around the world destroyed.
No.
I don't think so.
It's one of the things I really like about this movie. It's like the anti-Independence Day, isn't it?
Yeah. And also you've met his kind of neighbours and like they have, this is, I think, all in service of making Ray like the people's prince. But
absolutely.
But
he's such a popular guy in the neighborhood. He knows everybody.
Exactly, right? And, you know, all of his incredibly ethnically diverse friends are out, like, talking to him the whole time. But, like, you've met the neighbors who have, like, an infant, a babe in arms. And, like, there's a married couple on the other side. And, it's all just, you know, vaporized in the space of 30 seconds. In what is, like, you know, like you said, there are two... Those are two like back-to-back incredibly showpiece special effects shots.
That's something that I actually really like about the movie is that it kind of doesn't lean into the triumphant spirit of the people banding together. You know, you get the sense that he's really well liked in the neighborhood and. In a lot of movies, you know, that would have been your entire cast and you're watching everybody kind of band together. But no, they're just wiped out. Mm-hmm. You don't see them again, anybody that he talks to in the first sort of couple of minutes.
Nobody in this film bands together.
No.
Everyone is out for themselves and that is it.
There's a moment where it looks like he meets up with some friends, like people that he recognises, and you think, okay, they're going to sort of band. No. They 1 minute before he has to leave them behind.
Yeah.
It's bleak!
The only character who even shows any hint of wanting to look after people other than himself or family is the son. Because, you know, he climbs up on the ferry to help people over. Yes. He runs off to the military because he thinks people should be doing something. And he's still a fucking idiot. Like, I spend the whole time being like, you are a cretin, stop doing this.
But the thing with the bit, I mean, maybe we can talk about this when we get to it. But the bit with the military is that he says, like, I have to see this. I want to be here. Like, it's not even like they need my help. He's just like, I want to see... I have to be here. It doesn't make any sense.
So you are aware that you are literally experiencing this right now.
But I think it speaks to that wave of people after 9/11 who signed up for the army in some kind of misguided feeling of like, well, I want to go somewhere and take my revenge. You know, we need to get our own back for what happened on our home soil and stuff, you know. It's kind of a stand-in for that.
There's almost a throwaway line that is kind of that sort of vibe, where when everyone's trying to get on the ferry, there's a woman just going, we've got enough of this kind of blood, what we need is this. And it's just, it's really in the background almost, but it's like, it just gives you that hint of, oh, people are really like looking out for each other and reacting to this.
That's
in a very
not how
way.
I took that at all, Tom. That's not how I took that at all.
I assumed they had enough of that blood because people were donating. I'm pretty sure they explicitly say people have donated enough of that blood.
I think it's because they're taking it from bodies, isn't it?
No. Oh, God. I assumed it was donations.
Are you mental?
Can you do that?
What do you mean?
Of course you can. No, I'm sure.
You empty it into a bucket. You take it from there.
Bring it down British Heart Foundation or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like the popcorn at cinemas.
Yeah.
Because you've got like one type, another type, but then you've got a bucket of mixed.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Which just sort of take your
just
pick from the
around.
Blood.
If you mix blood types, you know when you get certain fluids and they kind of like separate into layers in like a vessel? Do you think that would happen?
Like cocktails, like cocktails of two halves.
Yeah, like shots or whatever, where you get like
drink of two halves.
Or would it just be like, you know, blood punch?
I think it'd be blood punch.
Right.
I think it would, yeah. I think it would all just
Is that what they
co-mingle.
Mean when they say universal donor? Because they're all in there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Because they've
got
all the different letters in there, so it's just like anything will do.
Adam, did you think they were dragging the dead corpses of people up to the pit of pulp?
I don't think that's a completely mad thing to think, though. Because presumably
they had a medical center nearby, because that bit of it. Look, we'll talk about it when we get to it. But this is the bit with the ferry that is like policed, and they have the army there. Yeah. So I assumed they had some kind of medical thing nearby, and like they were just had an overabundance of a certain kind of blood, but not because of donation. I don't think anybody in this situation is stopping to do a quick blood donation, Tom.
I agree, Adam, but that's what they're saying. I don't know how to tell you.
Because also, the problem with the dead body theory is that there's like most people have just like turned into dust.
So that's a good point. There's no one dead unless they've been shot in the head.
Well, there are
Me,
because
by my own hand.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam, for your donation.
Yeah.
No, you're right. What I think is mental. Adam, yeah, that's not how it works.
Adam just walking into the Red Cross and then shooting himself in the head.
They're like, what a fucking waste.
Is this how this works?
That's 8 pints right there.
Yeah. Well, there's the other time you see, other than the blood pulping centre, the other time that you see loads of dead bodies is the river when they all
yeah.
All the so they're dragging out the river to pulp, Chris. That's what's happening.
Yeah, they're dredging it. Yeah.
We're getting so far. We're taking disparate bits of the movie. They drive to their mother's house, right? But it's deserted. And they have a brief argument over what to eat in what I think is quite a sad scene. And it reminds me of this. I really like food scenes in apocalyptic movies. I can only think of two. There's this one where he throws the peanut butter thing at the window because he doesn't know his own daughter is allergic to peanuts. What a piece of shit. Mm-hmm. And there's the one in Signs. Where Mel Gibson cries into his mashed potato. both very arresting scenes. And they go down to the basement where they're going to spend the night, but they wake up to some kind of noise, which becomes this huge, like deafening roar, and they have to rush into a sub-basement, the basement's utility room, and kind of lock the door in there. And when he wakes up, this is another sort of very showy thing, is like the shot that follows him out of the basement and then pulls back far enough that you realise not very much of the house is standing there, and a plane has crashed there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the commotion from the previous night was.
The hullabaloo.
I've seen that set. That's in the Universal Studio tour. It looks rad. It's a really well done set of like the plane with the roof torn off it, and any other like movie like this, that would have been a huge set piece, watching the plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
And instead here it's just from Ray's point of view, and he bumps into a news reporting team who then kind of act as our little bit of exposition. They fill him in what's going on. Things have travelled down in the lightning into these machines that had been buried under the ground for thousands of years before humans had built things like roads over them and stuff, right?
It doesn't make
any sense,
because it's much easier to leave stuff behind for a million years and then shoot yourself into it rather than just to arrive in it.
Well, are you telling me that like in the thousands of years of human excavation and like building sewers, and
they've never hit one?
Right, exactly.
They haven't hit one. Yeah, that is a leap of you have to suspend your disbelief on that one.
Hmm.
I don't think that the point is that they want the planet, though. I don't think it's a territory war. They want us.
Is it a is it supposed to be like a sleeper cell analog?
Kind of, maybe, yeah, or certainly something for like, this attack has technically come from something foreign, but it's on home soil.
Yeah,
and that is new for this version. This is the only version of War of the Worlds where the machines are buried in the ground and later picked up, which is an interesting thing to change. And it was Spielberg's suggestion as well. The original script had flying saucers and
right. Because H.G. Wells, despite being a pioneer of the genre, essentially, still had the foresight to think that if an alien species is attacking in the present day, they probably want to use technology that's present and not 1,000 to 1,000,000 years old. imagining us invading a planet and instead of taking nukes, like we took sticks. Why would you do that?
Maybe. Well, I don't know. Well, I assume like, I do kind of buy it. I don't think it's that much of a leap. And I think the whole thing is that they want humans. They had to wait for us to kind of evolve. Or maybe these are on loads of planets. And
I did read something that suggested that essentially humanity is just like one massive cattle ranch. Like we're basically just being seeded and then allowed to get to a certain population point where they're just like, right now we reap the harvest.
Yeah, because they're not like I said, they're not here for territory. Like it becomes apparent that what they need is like our blood, basically.
Yeah.
They do genuinely have a body pulping farm that harvests the
unlike
blood
the,
for us.
The Red Cross.
That's true. Yeah.
and in that news, I actually really like that we get all of our information from characters that we meet. Again, just sort of like instills that like that sort of thing of confusion and panic. But there's also a little comment on the media where the reporter asks if she asks Ray if he was in the plane that crashed, and it looks like that she's going to offer him help. But then when he says no, she goes, oh, that's a shame. It would have made a great story. And then they drive off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one thing I thought this time is the... So I think this is the first time that anyone refers to them as tripods.
Yes.
And I wonder if that is supposed to be because they work in media and with cameras.
Interesting. Mm. Yes. I hadn't put that together. Maybe. Yeah. Huh. Is that not something you would just call something with three legs? Maybe.
I don't know. But quite possibly. But it seems like a very neat fit.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Quite possibly.
Yeah, I don't think anyone says it before or after that I can think of.
They also never mention the word alien or Martian, which is from the original book. They never refer to really what they are.
I'm going to be honest, if we get to 2005 and humanity has not figured out there's a giant alien, super advanced alien race the next planet over, we deserve to be wiped out.
Yeah,
absolute cretins.
Ray gathers the fam and they set out again in the minivan. They drive for a while and pull over when Rachel needs to use the bathroom. This, you know, he's trying to be fatherly and make sure she stays in sight, and she doesn't, and she stops by a river, and when she looks at the water, it's that bit where there are like dozens of human bodies floating across the river, and Ray has to like find her and take her away from that. And then when they make it back to the truck, the army are passing by. A lot of this film is quite on the nose. That's the first bit where we get like Robbie kind of overcome with anger, mm-hmm. wants to join the counterattack against the invading force, with Ray trying to kind of like reason with Robbie. It's I like that they have to have that conversation shouting over the convoy. That makes it feel very kind of like spur of the moment and quite real. And there's two moments where I start to feel a bit bad for it. He's a piece of shit, no doubt about it. But I do feel bad for him. I do get the impression that he wants to be there for his children and just is absolutely incapable. There's also the thing that, like, Tom Cruise is kind of playing his own dad in this movie. A dad who was absent, and when he wasn't absent, he was abusive. And I don't think Ray is abusive in this movie, but I think Cruise is drawing on a lot of, like, past experiences, maybe. But kind of injecting more of that. Well, like you said, Chris, like maybe his one redeeming factor is that he loves his kids, right? But the two moments here back to back are like Robbie saying that the only reason they're heading for Boston is so that Ray can dump them and then only worry about himself as usual. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's savage. And then immediately after, Rachel saying to Robbie that if Robbie leaves, there'll be nobody to look after her. And Ray has stood like right there, which is like devastating.
The reason they're so painful, I think, both of those statements, is that they're completely true.
Yeah, and everybody knows it. Yeah. Like, Ray knows it, the kids know it, the audience knows it. The people driving past on the army convoy, they know it. They can tell immediately.
Yeah, they're like, well, we can't pick this kid up, because otherwise who's going to look after the girl?
Yeah, exactly. It's not going to be that piece of shit dad that stood over there. But then, you know, Ray lets Robbie drive for a little while so that he can get some sleep. And they come to a small town where, like, a bunch of evacuated people have gathered, and the crowd very quickly become hostile. And you think it's going to go the other way. You get shots of, like, what people have taken from their home, which I thought was very interesting in terms of, like, news footage we see of refugees and asylum seekers traveling with very little things. It's interesting that we see someone who's taken their horse, someone who's taken like their books, someone who's taken other, like someone who's stocked up on water. You see all these kind of disparate people sort of coalescing. But of course they've got a car, so very quickly the crowd become hostile towards Ray and his family, and they want the vehicle. Ray and Robbie are forcefully pulled from the truck and beaten by the mob, and this movie just kind of gets increasingly bleak as we get further into it, with increasingly distressing imagery. I think the shot of the guy trying to get into the car through the windscreen, and he's peeling it back, and he's kind of tearing his hands up in the process, and there's blood all over the glass. That's gonna stay with me for a little while. Every time I see it, I just go, oh, fucking hell. Like, it's just uncomfortable. And Ray eventually then fires his gun into the air, which he grabbed back at the house, but is met with another gun. And then he takes Rachel from the car and they go into a diner. And then we see in the background just somebody using Ray's gun to shoot the new driver of the car, and then the mob taking over the car again. And lots of films around this time like were made either about 9/11 or using 9/11 adjacent imagery, but a lot of them, like we've said, like focus on the banding together of the people and the triumph of the human spirit. And it's so weird to me that Spielberg, of all people, is the one to focus on the absolute desolation of that spirit and like the despair that is present in events like these. yeah, you would expect Spielberg to be the guy who, where like this movie ends on a shot of the American flag with loads of trumpets blaring and stuff, and he just refuses to give in to that. It's interesting, I think.
Yeah.
But seconds after this sequence, they do approach the ferry, and there is a woman shouting about how people have given too much blood of one type.
Yeah, that's true. So they've been pulping the dead bodies.
Exactly. They're dragging the bullet-ridden corpses and pulping their juice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They make their way to a ferry, which is a river crossing, having first had to stop at a railway track. And the thing that passes is a train completely on fire. The ferry section is again like kind of Spielberg bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's kind of it's elaborate and very very effective. Like they're trying to get on the ferry, the tripods arrive, they're helping people on board. It's the first time we see Ray worried about other people. And saying, you know, there's room for others on board. He finds friends, and this is what I was saying, they're like instantly abandoned. Another depressing idea, like they can't get on the ferry.
Mm-hmm.
But they do make it onto the ferry, and the ferry leaves, but there's only one in the bloody water, guys.
Mm.
Oh. Bloody hell, another bloody tripod.
Because this isn't Signs. Very important to remember, yeah, this exactly. isn't Signs, and they will go in the water.
Yeah,
they I love the idea of everyone
desperately racing onto a ferry with a tripod in the distance being like, don't worry guys, this is the fastest mode of transport to escape these giant tripods.
Well, what else are they going to do?
I know, it's obviously
such a desperate situation.
Yeah,
know?
Just chugging along at like 10 miles per hour. Come on.
The thing watching that ferry scene is that I don't think you would make that scene in the same way if you made it now. And I think it's extremely effective, maybe like even more so now that we're used to kind of like the modern state of spectacle filmmaking, that the way Spielberg does it is just by having hundreds and hundreds of people running down the road, like on a, you know, long lens, and they're, you know, it's just a real crowd of people really running and selling how panicked they all are. And it's so much, for some reason, it struck me as being so much more effective than, you know, when you see in blockbuster films now where there's like hordes of people, but you can, there's like a kind of feeling of artificiality about it. It's just like the carjacking and ferry scene back to back are just so distressing. In the way
they
depict, because I think like you said, even though it's Tom Cruise, he's just like a nobody in this film, and it's rare that you see these films from the perspective of a nobody rather than like Will Smith in a fighter jet or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Usually you're following some kind of military guy and also the president of the United States,
exactly.
And also the guy that discovered the meteor threat or the alien threat or whatever.
Whereas
some like standard guy who's trying to figure it out as he goes.
Exactly. Like a longshoreman who's a terrible father. And it's just incredibly affecting. I think it's so much easier to imagine yourself in that scenario than it would be if it's, you know, like you said, Independence Day. And it's just terrifying. It's absolutely like as
it is.
This is probably the bit where I'd shoot myself in the head. Yeah,
for sure. There's so many like little bits that Spielberg adds into it that just make me go like, fucking hell. Like there's a standard sort of action kind of bit that you would see in loads of movies like this if you were shooting a ferry scene like this, which is that the family they're like in the water. And then a car falls on them and pushes them like deeper into the river. That's kind of your standard sort of action thing, which is stressful in and of itself. But then Spielberg cuts to the inside of the car that fell on them to reveal that there's a family inside of it banging on the glass, trying to get out as the car fills with water.
Yeah.
It's fucking horrible.
It's just, it's
really
like,
really bleak.
It's, yeah, it's distress upon distress upon distress. It's like you said, it's incredibly bleak and very, I think it's like, I think you've said a bunch of times that it's a very scary film, and I get why
it's
people
scary,
I get why people don't find it scary in like a kind of horror, modern horror way.
Yeah.
If they were watching it nowadays. But I think there's like a specific kind of type of horror where things are just incredibly upsetting. And I think this has so many like powerfully upsetting moments, even though it's a 12A. Like the amount of terror that he's able to communicate in what is essentially like a more or less bloodless, you know, swearing free 12A film.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing.
That's Spielberg, though. Like, I was very surprised at the cinema at the weekend to find out that Jaws was only a 12A. Mm. And there's, like, limbs going about all over the place.
Yeah,
I
think that's one of the ones
Jurassic Park is a PG as well.
Yeah, Jurassic Park being a PG is mad, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Jaws is one of the ones that they, like, reclassified, because I think it was a 15 or kind of, like, a higher rating at the time. But
I think it was a PG.
Yeah,
I'm sure I've seen Jaws as a PG and it's been re-rated.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they kind of went the other way with it, where they went, hang on, this is a bit strong for PG, isn't it?
Can I just check the guidance for PG about limbs coming off, guys?
I think Temple of Doom was the first, in, you know how like Spider-Man kind of prompted the 12A rating in this country to like to a degree? I think Temple of Doom, the Spielberg film, is the one that created PG-13 in America, because you'd lose money if you classified it as an R, but there's no way you can have that film as a PG. That film's very dark. But yeah, like that's why this film is so interesting to me, like in terms of Spielberg's career as well, because you'd never go like, oh yeah, Steven Spielberg, he makes bleak movies. You know, like I know he's made Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan and stuff, and he always has that sort of thing to his, he has that string to his bow. But it's not ever something he leans into as severely as he does here and in Munich. The two films that come out this year are very, very bleak. And I think when I was 15, this movie was not scary. I did not go to the cinema and come away going like, oh, that was really scary. I just came away thinking like, oh, that's an action sort of blockbuster. And I think that speaks to what you were talking about, Chris, is that the horror is wrapped up in kind of human empathy, which is something that you very much kind of don't have when you're 15.
Yeah, when you're 15, you're like, yeah, I'd punch an alien. And
yeah, exactly. Whereas now, like, we're all in our early 30s and we're fully aware of sort of like how we would react in a situation like this.
Yeah.
And it's
shooting ourselves in the head immediately.
It's shooting ourselves in the head immediately. But if we survive long enough, it's the thing that this film posits, I think, or the thing that this film focuses on, is that in situations like this, so often humans will completely disregard other humans. Mm. And a lot of this film is every man for himself. And that is a kind of a scary thought. You know, you are taught by movies that the overwhelming triumph of the human spirit will prevail. And in this movie, Spielberg's just like, oh, I don't think it will, actually.
Yeah. And like, considering everything that we've all been through over the last few years, it's very easy to imagine, you know, there would be people on YouTube saying, no, the tripods aren't real, mate. Like,
right, yeah.
Or like, you know, Joe Biden is controlling all the tripods or whatever. Yep. Like, there would be...
Have you noticed they're only going after the people that have taken the vaccine? That would be a huge talking point, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But there would be people who are like... I mean, there would probably be people who would be like, well, no, you just got... I'm going to ignore it. I'm just going to, you know, carry on living my life. I don't want to change my life because of a little alien invasion.
I mean, the thing that happens in most movies like this, and I'm thinking of like kind of like Independence Day, I think it happens. I think Jeff Goldblum's character is the one who maybe like discovers it. I might be wrong. I think I'm misremembering Independence Day. But you usually have that sort of like the tension between a character who's like, oh, this is coming, this is what's happening, and a bunch of people going, oh, well, I don't think it is, and we don't need to prepare for this or whatever. Completely absent in this movie. It's just... this is happening to people right now, and there is no discussion about... I mean, there's very little discussion about what it is that is happening. It's just people dealing with the things that are put in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
There is a scene where people are like, it's quite it's a very Spielberg, like, on the nose scene, but there's a scene where, like, there's a group of people saying, like, oh, well, I hear we've had it worse and nothing is happening over in Europe. And then it cuts to another group of people who are saying, I hear Europe got it the worst.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They're trying to swim away as the tripod starts grabbing people out of the water, but they do make it to the shore and travel onto what is essentially a battlefield, I think. And Robbie wants to join the tanks and the fighter jets that go overhead. And Ray has to leave Rachel somewhere safe, which he deems to be by that tree over there, to try and stop Robbie from going. But people think that she's on her own and sort of take her away. So he's left with a choice between his children and kind of has to let Robbie go. It is, again, very on the nose. It's a very, like, grand Spielberg moment.
Mm.
But Cruise's look of just absolute despondence as, like, Robbie, like, wriggles out of his grasp is really good. Tom Cruise, good actor, in my opinion.
That's the conclusion we've reached after 30 films.
Yeah. I don't like the way he sits on chairs, but he is a good actor.
Chris, you'll just have to trust us that he has sat on a chair in a convincing manner before.
Mm.
I can't think of anything.
He sits in a chair perfectly normally in Jerry Maguire. It's the thing he does. It's the shouting he does whilst in the chair.
Mm.
That's abnormal.
Do you know what? For the press tour for this movie, he did not sit on a chair in a normal manner.
No,
it's a very alarming way of using a chair or seating apparatus. the area that Robbie ran into is then entirely engulfed in flames, mm. and we see the tripod shields that protect them. And then, as Ray and Rachel are sort of leaving, they are called over by a man who owns a nearby house and offers them sanctuary in his basement. That's Ogilvy. It's Tim Robbins from Top Gun, most famously from Top Gun, of course. Yeah. And that first shot of him is excellent. It's brilliantly villainous. You know from the outset this guy is a whole issue, where he, like, leads them in, you don't know who he is, and then his face goes really close up to the lantern and for no reason just, like, pauses there so the audience can get used to him, and then he moves over to them.
It's Tim Robbins. I didn't know he was in this.
Exactly. Quick little applause break for Tim Robbins, and then we're back on with the movie. And it becomes pretty clear pretty quickly to Ray that Ogilvy is mentally unstable, mm-hmm. and plans to tunnel out of the basement. We're not really sure to where. It's a very broad performance from Tim Robbins. It's very effective. Yeah. I hate this guy so much. He makes me very nervous.
Yeah, he wants to tunnel to the cities because there are more tunnels that are already built there.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Okay, great.
It's a sound logic. It's a sound
logic. Is he the guy who says... Is there a character who says the famous line in this, which I think is a H.G. Wells line, about this is no more a fight between humans and aliens as it is between humans and ants or something like that, or humans and maggots?
There's a line,
he does
something
say something
like
along
that.
Those lines.
Is Ogilvy the one who says that?
I can't remember.
I can't think who else
it
would
this morning.
Yeah, because I was thinking about that in retrospect, and it doesn't quite track with his plan then to tunnel up from underground and kill all the aliens.
Yeah. which is one man resistance.
Like, I don't think the maggots are doing that, are they?
Well, you don't know, Chris. No, they've been waiting for a million years.
Yeah.
And now they're going to rise up.
Mm. Well, interestingly, this is absolutely true. Earlier, I went outside and my downstairs neighbour was there. And he said, he was bringing the bins in. And he said, there's loads of maggots in the bin. And I was like, oh, right, that's annoying. And then he opened the bin and he was like, oh, they're all gone. That's really weird. I just went to boil the kettle because I was going to pour some hot water in there to kill the maggots. And now they're all gone. Where have the maggots gone?
That's the question we all need to ask ourselves.
Yeah.
Where have the maggots gone?
The question I'm asking is, who stole my maggots that I accidentally threw away?
Well, if anyone's got any information, maybe you can.
If anyone sees some maggots for sale on Gumtree,
we know what's happened. Yeah. I mean, they're stuck in this fucking basement with this fucking guy. And then there's a series of loud noises. And they have to hide. And a snake-like probe is sent into the basement, which the group narrowly avoids detection. And then the probe is kind of withdrawn after a few minutes. And then later, three of the aliens enter the basement. They are also three-legged, implying that the machines are built in their own image.
Yes, their head is the same shape as the tripod's head as
Right? Yeah, it would be like if we walked around in giant mech suits.
Yes, or drove cars that were shaped like big heads.
Chris, have you seen Transformers?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, humanoid cars.
There's
a
cute little E.T. gag here, right?
Yes. Remind me what it
with
is.
The alien like plays with a bike, I think.
Yeah.
And like knocks it off the wall.
Oh, the bike wheel.
I'm assuming that that's like a alien plus bike in a Spielberg movie. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, Spielberg, it's E.T.
Well, I think it was a reference to the book.
Yeah, I think it's also in the book.
Oh, really?
The narrator in the book remarks that nothing that the Martians used had any kind of wheel, and wonders if they skipped the invention of the wheel. So Spielberg includes them being fascinated at the idea of a wheel in the movie.
Or an antivirus, again, this is like, of any kind.
Yeah, sure. Well, they're heavily anti-vax, aren't they? Again, it's Spielberg's bread and butter. Like, to go back to Jurassic Park again, it has the same sort of tension and attention to detail as this reminded me of the raptors in the kitchen sequence, them trying to avoid the aliens and the big snake-like thing that comes in. Ray also has to stop Ogilvy from shooting them with his shotgun.
And the axe as well. Doesn't he stand over it with an axe for like 30 seconds?
He does. Yeah, it's really tense. Yeah. And then the aliens leave when their horn sounds, which is when Ray discovers that the aliens are covering the landscape with like this kind of vine, this plant that has been developed from the blood of the humans they capture. It's another fucking hell moment when you look at the landscape and it's covered in what is basically them repurposing the remains of the humans that they've captured.
Yeah.
Adam, at this point, did you consider the possibility that the aliens only came to Earth in order to harvest the crew's goo?
Do you think that might be the crew's goo?
I think they're going through
every human one by one,
yeah,
so that they can find Tom Cruise.
Yeah, and harvest his
goo. No, it never crossed my mind. I'm going to be honest. No.
Ask Rooney.
When Ogilvy finds out that that's the plan, he becomes very agitated and starts digging even more frantically. And he starts muttering like, "Not my blood." It's really funny. Ray tries to calm him, and again, more bleak territory. He realizes that he can't, so he's got to ask his daughter to put on headphones, put her music on, because he's going to gently kill this man, basically. It's the only way that he will survive is by killing another human being. Because the aliens are nearby, aren't they?
Well, or I suppose. I mean, he can't be I guess he could stay there forever, couldn't he? Because there's food and
it's another selfish decision, right? Like, this is a safe environment, so I'm going to kill the person that's making it unsafe.
Yeah. He's not a good father to Ogilvy, is he?
No, he's not.
doesn't even know that Ogilvy is allergic to having his head beaten in with a shovel.
that moment is so dark as well. And then they go to sleep and wake up and the alien probe has returned and they've been discovered. And that's when he uses the axe to cut the eye. But Rachel's already fled the house and he goes to rescue her. There's a bit of like a kind of a small like action scene there. But eventually, like, he does get captured by the tripod and is kept in this little cage that it has under with loads of other humans. But he's also rescued from a Humvee that he was in. He now has a little string of grenades. So this is like his big kind of hero moment, right? Like, because the tripod tries to suck people up through what is essentially a giant anus. There's it is biological, right? It is
biological. It's quite difficult to pass the the process that the tripods go through, because earlier we see a person being like pinned down and then injected with a needle, which is presumably how they harvest the blood.
Yeah.
That's certainly the implication. But so then what is the purpose of the whole, like, you know, anus sucking part?
Well, I think it's because they need, I think that's how they pulp the bodies, because famously, as everybody knows, you can't harvest blood from dead bodies, and everybody knows that, and no one would ever suggest that you could. So they need
insane,
to keep you need to keep the humans alive so you can harvest them one by one and then spray the landscape with their blood, I guess.
But then, like,
I mean, it's horrible things to have to consider.
You think they'd just be in the cage and then taken out of the cage one by one and placed on the, you know, placed somewhere and then injected, you know, like have all their blood sucked out.
I think you're trying to make sense of the processes of an alien.
Yeah.
Why isn't this the most efficient way of doing it?
I think the most efficient way is to inject them. But if you've got lots of humans running about, and obviously you don't want to harvest
the dead
bodies.
But what I'm asking is that is there some sort of like meat grinder inside the tripods, do we think?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's
so
fine.
I think these are just the storage things. So it has its primary jabber, and then it's like, oh, I've got too many humans to handle. I'll put them in my pods, and that'll deal with the rest. It's less efficient, but it just gets on.
It's
with
messy
it.
For me. It's too. Yeah. They thought of two ways that they wanted to show the same thing, didn't they? Like,
yeah.
Because they couldn't show a giant anus sucking up a person in the sky from Tom Cruise's perspective in a basement, so they had to do a different one.
Well, I think they probably thought of the one that makes sense, which is the like spiking, sucking up thing, right?
Starship Troopers.
I think that's too slow.
I agree, you've got a big crowd
of people.
Absolutely, yeah. I agree. But they wanted to show that because they wanted to get across this is where the red is coming from, right?
Yeah.
But then they also have to have the thing with like people being sucked up into the tripod because they need a thing for Tom Cruise to do to be cool.
Yeah. And
I think that is essentially where that comes from.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, I also don't know how the aliens would discriminate between, okay, these people we're going to turn to ash and these people we're going to harvest.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that doesn't make sense to me about Tom, earlier you said about people being raised, like all humans are being raised as cattle. Now, as far as I'm aware, when farmers come to like sell their cattle as meat, they don't like just walk into the field with a flamethrower and like atomize every single cow.
Like 90% of them.
I mean, what you're saying makes sense, Chris, but I don't know if you've ever been to a farm and seen the abattoir process.
I've never seen that part of the process, put it that way.
No. Adam, before we go any further, I just want to reiterate with your mental blood theories that Tom Cruise even explained how you can't harvest dead blood in the film interview with the vampire.
I don't think so.
He says you can't drink dead blood. It'll kill you.
What? Yeah, but
if a vampire
he's a
can't
fucking
drink
vampire.
It.
It's because he's a fucking vampire, Tom. What are you talking about? The blood is there. He can drink it. He just shouldn't. It's not that he can't.
Adam, you can inject yourself with dead blood, but you shouldn't.
You shouldn't inject yourself with blood anyway, Tom, from a living or dead person. What are you talking about?
What I think we've discovered is that none of us have any fucking clue what we're talking about.
We don't know. We've got no idea about
it's
how
three,
blood
three people
works.
Arguing, and we each say an argument which is immediately refuted by the argument of the next person. And we're like, oh,
even
yeah.
though both arguments Chris, have no evidence behind them.
I base all of my health decisions on 1994's Interview with the Vampire.
Yeah. Well, what I've also done is just describe any podcast there.
Yeah, absolutely. We're three white guys with beards on a podcast.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about things about which we have very little understanding.
With utmost confidence.
Yeah,
arrogance
absolutely.
Even.
Full confidence.
The arrogance.
The hubris.
To broadcast like at the time of recording 90 minutes of the three of us just saying I don't know, can you take blood out of dead people and then put that out and then go that's good, people want to listen to that. And I'm saying this on your podcast, but my podcast is even worse, if anything.
So, Adam, if somebody's dead, their heart's not pumping, so you'd have to
suck on it, isn't it?
But the blood
it's
got is still there, isn't it? The blood's still there. Know, the blood doesn't just stop being there, Tom.
But the Red Cross would have to suck it out like they were siphoning petrol out of a car.
Well, yeah, what, you like mean that like with a syringe? You mean that with a syringe, like they do when you're alive? Like they do when you're alive, then? What do you think they do... What do you think they do when you're alive, Tom?
And I think they
just
jab...
open a wound and you just bleed into a bucket or something. What are you talking about?
I think they jab one end of a pipe in and then suck the other end and then spit the first bit into the bucket.
Yeah.
That is essentially what they do, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, they put a little needle in attached to a tube and then it vacuums it out. Yeah. No? I don't know.
It's happened again. We've done it again.
I don't know.
We keep falling into the trap of start. You think of something and then you go, yeah, no, this makes perfect sense. And then you say it aloud and then you're like, no, Chris, what the fuck are you talking about? You've never drawn blood in your life. What are you talking about?
Guys, should we go back to discussing how this film's an analogy for 9/11, an event that we were between 8 and 12 and did not witness in any way, shape or form? Yeah.
Come on, we witnessed it on TV, did we not?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I got home from school aged, what, 12?
We would have, we would have been 12. I talked about this on another podcast recently, I'm sure I did. Coming home from school at like, we got kicked out at like 2:35 from school, which would have been, we were like right in that sort of like weird spot where we got home and put on the TV expecting to watch our whatever shows we watched when we got home from school when we were 12. My Parents Are Aliens or something like that, maybe. To be confronted with the news that there had been an accident, right? Yeah. Because one plane had hit the World Trade Center. And then I saw the second plane hit live. It was very odd. Very odd day.
God, this has been a tonal shift, hasn't it, over the last couple of
years? Yeah, what a tonal shift. Sorry, guys, I really brought it down. Tom Cruise does get his hero moment because the anus tries to suck him.
What a segue.
But people like grab him back, right, and pull him out of the whatever mechanism it is that they're using. And then it reveals that, like, oh, he's just got the pins of the grenade now. Excellent. Well, I love it when that happens in movies.
I want to talk about this because question number one, what on earth are his teeth made out of? And secondly, is he spits out, like, all five pins. Now, do you think that he has put all the pins in one go? Like... I'm miming it. Unfortunately, you can't see this.
Yeah,
listener.
Yeah.
You like put all like. Imagine you have like five key rings.
Looks like he's trying to devour a very large penis.
That's what I'm taking inspiration from. Certainly.
Yeah.
But imagine that would be very difficult to do in like a panic situation. Or do you he pulled one out and then keeping that one in his mouth for some reason, pulled another one out and then did that on all of them?
So I think secret option C is he pulled them out by hand but then kept putting them in his mouth.
For a tasty treat before he dies.
In case he needed to put it back in. Huge mistake.
I think he wanted to have his hero moment. He knows he's going to be pulled out and then he can go, look what's in my mouth. Five grenade pins.
Well, that's it. Once again, it's a conceit for the sake of making entertaining films.
I think this is what films are for. I think fundamentally, this is what the whole art form of cinema is about, is presenting stupid things for entertainment.
Yeah.
So I like the idea that Tom Cruise put the pins back in his mouth.
So
he could spit them out in front of his daughter and be like, yeah, you know what's going to happen.
I'm a very big fan of things that seem absolutely fine in movies at the time, and then you think about them for more than 30 seconds and you're like, well, that didn't make any fucking sense at all.
That's what the Mission Impossible movies are so good at.
Oh, yeah.
Is that you're watching it going like, yeah, this absolutely seems reasonable. And then you think about it for 5 seconds and you go, no sense at all. That's absolutely insane. But, you know, it's a cool movie moment and the grenades explode inside the tripod and the cage is released and it frees everyone. And then we're kind of, this is kind of the end of the movie, interestingly, because Ray and Rachel then like make it to Boston and they're directed by more soldiers. And Ray notices that the red weeds are dying and that a tripod has come down. And then Ray notices that a small flock of birds have landed on the tripod, which means that its shield is not functioning. And then Ray relays this to a captain standing by who orders missiles to be fired, because Ray is the best and nobody else could have possibly noticed that, that bird thing. He has to tell the military what to do.
That's another annoying scene.
So easily avoidable as well. Just have him walk past somebody else who notices it.
Yeah.
Right? But I guess they want to make him an active sort of part of the denouement of the movie. They defeat the aliens. They're reunited with their mother. Robbie is there. He survived. He hugs his dad. Big dad moment. Big Spielberg dad moment. Mm-hmm. And then the narrator comes back and informs us that the aliens had killed billions. However, they were defenseless against disease-carrying bacteria to which humans have long been immune. And that's the end of the movie. What did you think of the movie, guys?
Yeah, I think it's excellent. I think it's again, you know, it's a film that maybe falls apart in a few places when you start thinking about it too hard. But I think in terms of the feelings that it's trying to conjure when you're watching it and the presentation of like we've kind of said a bunch of times, I don't think there's many kind of, you know, apocalypse or alien invasion films that that feel like this, where it's so on the ground and so kind of like in a minor key the whole way through. And I think it's kind of triumphant in that sense, as a film. I think it's just like it's a very kind of standard, it's a film that is a very standard kind of example of its genre, but is like massively elevated by the quality of the filmmaking.
I like this quite a bit. I like that it's dark and gritty and sad, and I like that it's not sort of very hoorah, you know, which is the tendency of a lot of especially American films made around this time, reacting to, you know, the terrorist attack and the war on terror. Even the ending doesn't really address like the triumph of the human spirit or anything. It's just the threat went away, and it focuses on like the family dynamic more than the wider picture. It's not like those big like sci-fi disaster epics. Like I was thinking of like The Day After Tomorrow and Independence Day and Deep Impact, like that focus on numerous perspectives and feature the destruction, like you were saying, Tom, of like worldwide landmarks and stuff like that. This is just that insular story. Follows one man trying to kind of just keep his family together, basically. And I think that makes it feel much more relatable and more real and more distressing. And it is not the fun Friday Night Alien movie that you would expect from Spielberg and Tom Cruise. When you think sci-fi, Tom Cruise, Spielberg, aliens, not expecting the bleak sort of outlook of the human spirit that is in this one. It's much more interesting than it could have been. So we do scores. I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. That's what I'm going to give it. Tom, talk to me. Chris, give us a score.
Yeah, Chris first.
Score. I think 4 out of 5 is the right score. Yeah, I think it's...
Thank you. It's correct. I've scored it correctly.
Yeah, well, like, you know, I agree. I agree with everything you've said. And I think it's maybe not one of those films like Jaws that is always going to be remembered as one of Steven Spielberg's, you know, finest pieces of work, but I think it's
right.
It achieves everything it sets out to do in like an like I said, in a immaculate fashion, really.
See, I agree with everything you've both said, and tonally, however. To some degree. I like it tonally. I like that it's bleak. I'm not satisfied by the ending, which I know is the ending from the book. Obviously, I think it's a really good concept for an ending. I like the idea that something really small and overlooked could bring down the hyper-advanced alien species. But I don't think it's done particularly, maybe not well, but like it's not done in a satisfactory way. least for me personally here, it's just if we didn't have Morgan Freeman literally telling us what the ending of the film was, we wouldn't have an ending of the film. It would literally just be, and then the war stopped, and that's, and then the film ended, which is terrible.
But I think I'd probably I think that would be quite a brave and interesting ending if the, you know, like the aliens all died of like a mystery disease, and because you're Ray, you don't know what, you don't know that it's the common cold, right?
I think that would be more effective.
Yeah.
Right, if you just cut out the voiceover, mm-hmm. so it literally did just end and it wasn't explained, then that would say more than...
Yeah,
than,
Spielberg.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing. The other thing that annoys me about the ending
yes.
is the son surviving.
Yeah, 100%.
That pisses me off. Because he walked into an area that just got napalmed.
Yeah,
he's dead. Like, he is dead. There is no reason to bring him back except for the classic Spielberg. And look, everyone's family dynamic was very happy. Like, Spielberg is like one bad decision away from having... And randomly, the new stepdad died. So now Tom Cruise and the wife can get back together.
No, it's like right, out, it's, from behind the sun, Manny, like the car
yeah. mechanics. Hey, yeah. I'm fine.
yeah, yeah the ending just doesn't... I think he drops the ball for the ending, personally.
Yeah.
It's rushed. It doesn't need explaining, or it needs developing more, so you don't have to literally just say it, otherwise it doesn't work.
So I think for a blockbuster film like this, I think the ending does need explaining. I think people would be broadly unhappy with the idea that, we defeated one of these tripods and then they all started like falling and you're never told why.
Yeah.
I think that would be probably unsatisfactory to a lot of people.
Agreed. From a blockbuster perspective, that wouldn't land. From a better film perspective, I think it would be better if you didn't have the Morgan.
Yeah.
It's the fact that it's also, maybe it wasn't so bad then, but for us now in 2022, having Morgan Freeman narrate the ending so that you know what happened is pretty...
It does feel a bit trad. You know? Yeah.
Well, it's very, he's just riding the post Bruce Almighty, like he is the voice of God situation, right?
Yeah, that's true. March of the Penguins. He did March of the Penguins, right? Yeah.
But I mean, all that said, still giving it 3.5 stars.
Lovely stuff.
I had
lovely
a lot stuff. Of fun. It's a well-made film. It just, it would have been four if it hadn't dropped the ball.
He is bookending the film with the book, basically. Mm. That is, he narrates the first paragraph and the last paragraph of the book, I suppose.
Do you think they got him to narrate the whole book and just use the first and last paragraph?
Yeah, I think
paragraph.
They did. Yeah, they edited out the middle 18 hours. what about cruisiness, though? I found this one very difficult to rate on the cruisiness scale because I don't think he's bringing a whole lot of the stuff that makes Cruise, but I do think you would end up with a slightly different movie if it wasn't Tom Cruise, kind of. I think you need to have a certain outside perspective of Tom Cruise in order for some of this movie to work. Does that make sense?
He does bring the somewhat stereotypical, at this point, sort of nervous energy that we've covered before. Is that sort of like in control, but not really in control? Like just about hanging on, which is quite Cruise-y. And obviously it is an action movie, so you do get a lot of Cruise running.
Yeah, well, the first like quarter of the film, there is a lot of running, but actually the running kind of tapers off quite significantly towards the middle of the film, I think.
And he doesn't do the full Tom Cruise run, because we know he can run a lot faster than in this film. Because obviously if he was running that fast away from the tripods, he'd just escape.
He'd
outrun everyone in the street. He had to keep pace with the crowd, which is ludicrous.
Well, I think I mentioned this the last time I was on this podcast, but I think you said earlier the next film is Mission Impossible 3, right?
Yeah.
Now that
is the birth of the Tom Cruise run.
That is
as we know it
today. The birth, and I'd say possibly the pinnacle of the Tom Cruise run. That shot of him running along the riverside in wherever it is.
So you think it's going to end, and it doesn't end.
No, and it's like a 60-second long sprinting scene.
Yeah.
Which I maintain is like one of the most impressive stunts ever, and it's just a man running for like really, really fast, really for a really long time.
I guess I've given it a 6 out of 10 for Cruiseness. because there's not loads of cruisiness going on, I guess. Maybe.
I'm torn between a 6 and a 7.
Mm.
Sure. I've got 7 written down and I called an audible at the last minute and said 6.
I'm going to stick with 7 because I've got that written down.
All right, cool. Chris, what do you reckon?
I think 6 is right. I mean, I'm very confused by the scoring
system.
Yes, again,
I have scored correctly.
Yeah,
yeah, well, it doesn't make any sense. I changed my score now.
I'm confused. I'm confused by the scoring system because I remember last time when I'd been pre-warned to rate the films and I rated them out of 10 and then you rated everything out of 5. And then this time I was like, oh yeah, it's out of 5, so it'll be 3. And then you've done 3 out of 5 for the film and then out of 10 for the cruisiness.
I have to say, historically, it is... The score of the film is out of 5 and the cruiseness is out of 10.
Right.
But
is that because a 10 out of 10...
You can have 0.5, so it is a 10-point scale.
Right, of course, yeah. So is it because a 10 out of 10 in cruiseness is worth 2 films?
Yes, I think so. Right, okay. I think that's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Actually, Adam?
Yeah?
I do want to drop it down to a 6 because I also want to drop Collateral down to a 7.
Interesting. What did you give it, an 8?
I gave it an 8, and I don't think it quite deserves an 8 because that's Mission stupid. Impossible territory. It's Mission Impossible territory.
But the thing about Collateral is you need that to be... It needs to be weird that it's Cruise doing a villain thing in order for that movie to work, I think. If it had been someone who just always plays villains, then it wouldn't have been as effective, I don't think. You need the Cruiseness in there.
Yeah, but he doesn't climb a skyscraper as Vincent. That's not how he gets out of the building with Jamie Lee Foxx.
Okay. Fine.
I don't
Would you guys recommend this movie?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I would. On the understanding that it's not the Friday night movie you would expect it to be. Before we do anything, let's check in with Cruise, because this year is a difficult time for him, maybe. A difficult time to be a Tom Cruise fan. Over the last couple of years, before War of the Worlds, he had increasingly become the poster boy for Scientology, right? He had been a member of the church since, 1986? Which has surprised a few of the guests that we've had on.
Because
he wasn't ever really that public about it. It's this period where you're like, ah, yes, Tom Cruise, the Scientologist who sometimes acts. He had kept his religion and work like relatively separate, but it was beginning to like kind of leak through now. The press were incredibly interested in the state of his relationship with his now ex-wife, Nicole Kidman. Pretty intrusive, in fact. And this led to some confrontation in the press. And as more things about Scientology worked their way into pop culture, people started to see Cruise as a bit of an oddball, I think. And on the set of War of the Worlds, he set up a Scientology booth on set to entice people into the religion, like a recruiting desk almost. Apparently, he nearly got Spielberg. That was a big part of the production, was Cruise courting and trying to get Spielberg on board with Scientology. Now, somebody, and I forget who, took Spielberg aside and kind of took him through what Scientology involved and their beliefs. And obviously that includes that psychiatrists were to blame for the Holocaust and things like that, which of course did not really vibe with Steven Spielberg, director of Schindler's List.
Nice.
So Cruise was pretty put out by that. He ended up never working with the person who told Spielberg that again. And I can't remember who it is, and I haven't got the name in my notes.
Dakota also, Fanning.
Also, Cruise could feel the tide of negativity coming his way, I think. He fired his publicist and hired his sister to replace them. And his sister's idea was to have Cruise do way more press than he had previously done as part of the promotional tour for War of the Worlds. And this included what ended up being a very heated exchange with Matt Lauer about antidepressants and Ritalin, which Cruise was heavily against. He also criticised Brooke Shields for taking antidepressants when she suffered from postpartum depression. The Matt Lauer interview is wild and uncomfortable. I'm assuming you guys have seen at least a clip of it.
Yeah.
You sent it to me as we were starting this podcast. Before episode 1, you're like, watch this one. This is good.
Yeah, it's a bit bizarre. And it's in the same block of promotion as the infamous appearance on Oprah. Now, it's taken us a long time to get here. We mentioned it in the first episode as being part of your conception of Tom Cruise, Tom.
Yeah.
We all know what happened. He jumped up and down on her sofa while proclaiming how in love he was. He had met Katie Holmes this year, 2005, and proposed to her 2 months after they met, and then almost immediately announced that she was pregnant. It was whirlwind stuff, real Hollywood romance stuff. Their relationship actually became public at the premiere of this movie, of War of the Worlds. Now, the Oprah sofa thing, right? I'm going to defend it. I don't think it's that weird. What do you guys think?
It's quite a long way down on the list of like weird things about Tom Cruise,
right,
isn't it?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
In isolation, no one would remember.
No.
Well, but well they would, remember, but it would be like, quirky.
It'd be cringe. It'd be endearing. Yeah, it wouldn't be like... Yeah. Yeah. The Katie Holmes thing as well is... Am I right? Now, have you guys seen Going Clear?
Yeah.
Is
there has been some discussion... It was on our original
on the docket. Right, nice.
Yeah, but I think we've just removed it. Okay. I think, right? I don't think we want to...
It's not
wanna,
a... Yeah. We came
it's
to the conclusion...
It's not a film.
Exactly.
Not a
he's not performing.
Yeah.
It would be unfair to judge it alongside everything else.
Because in that, don't they talk about how Tom Cruise had like an assistant who picked girlfriends for him and things like that? And
I think we might have talked about this on the podcast before. I've read the book Going Clear as well as watched the documentary, and there's a whole section in there about how a woman was interviewed, and one of the questions was like a fluffy kind of like, "What's your ideal date?" And she was like, "Oh, I don't know, maybe like, you know, like completely blue sky thinking, you know, get in a helicopter over New York and then we go to this really fancy restaurant in the top of a building or whatever." And then within the next couple of months, she found herself on that exact date with Tom Cruise. So they would kind of like audition girlfriends for him. Maybe? Yeah, I guess we'll never find out. The sofa thing like became such a big meme, I think, mm-hmm. and people point to that as like, oh, well, Tom Cruise is weird. But I think it's slightly less weird when you pop it into context, okay? So Oprah, at this point, that show is the biggest thing on TV at the time. And Oprah herself, an insane cultural icon. And the audience is in, like, frenzy mode already. I've read, like, people's accounts of that day, that fateful day. And it was like, one of the hottest days of the year. And, of course, the crowd are going to see they're going to see Oprah. Mm-hmm. B, they're potentially each going to be given like a fucking car or God knows what else, right? Members of that audience always leave with some insane gift where she goes, "And you get a car, and you get a car," and all that shit. So they're pretty amped. And C, they're about to see Tom Cruise, like one of the biggest movie stars of all time. So they are anticipating something like cataclysmic. And one thing we know that Tom Cruise is good at is matching energy or going above the energy that's in the room. On even the most basic of chat shows, he's like a fucking grinning ventriloquist dummy. So here, he's kind of matching that hysteria and he's following that energy and he's giving the crowd what they want. Mm. In the room, getting on the sofa was the perfect way to ride that wave. And on TV, it just looked a bit weird. But also, it's very odd that this is the thing that people leapt on when all of the anti-drug, anti-psychiatrist stuff exists. Because I'll defend the sofa, mm-hmm. but I won't defend that other stuff. That other stuff is really quite odd.
That's a sign of the times, though, right? In that I think nowadays someone would definitely get called up on that instantly.
Yeah.
But back then, maybe there was a bit more kind of unease about discussing that sort of thing in the public eye. But that's not to say that what Tom Cruise believes about antidepressants and mental health and all sorts is not like completely incomprehensible to anyone who's, you know, got even
it's
the slightest.
It's an insane statement to make, and I think with a perhaps a more skilled publicist, those remarks would never have come out.
No, and also he does a very, and again, I think this is like a Scientology thing, right? Where whenever he's in interviews and he feels like personally offended, he gets like incredibly like pointedly aggressive and like threatening, just maintaining the same like level of voice and the words that he's saying, but you can tell that like he's got a certain kind of like aggressive energy. Is this the same interview where he like demands an apology for someone there's an interview, I think it might be the same one, maybe I'm misremembering it, and he's like saying that they printed something about him in his personal life or something, and it was like not right, or like he's upset about it, and he kind of becomes very like...
Quite possibly that there are a few interviews around this time that are like that. There's one I sent you, Tom, where the interviewer asks about Nicole Kidman, and he's like, he's trying to justify it by like, oh, well, this is what my viewers want to know.
This is the one that
and
I'm Cruise, thinking of. Yeah.
Cruise is like, no, you want to know.
Yes.
Take responsibility for what you want to know. And then he tells him to put your manners back in.
Yeah,
which is, well, is it, doesn't a phrase he say, like, I've started using every day.
I'm pretty sure. At one point, doesn't he say, like, ask it again or something like that? And it's incredibly...
He's a good
like,
journalist. He persists. Yeah. And it's very odd. But I also think that like 2005 is like, that's like pre-Twitter. That is very nascent social media and very nascent memes. And I think Cruz jumping on a sofa is... much more highly memeable than his views on prescription drugs, I suppose. And so everyone starts saying he's weird and part of a cult, which is actually difficult to disagree with, but also it's always been the case. We had just transitioned to a different period of culture that was much more cynical and less willing to engage with earnestness, and also less willing, I think, to separate the artists from the art. For better and for worse. But the consensus amongst a lot of people was that Cruise was done. Box office poison. And I believe that this was his biggest opening weekend to date. Tom, how did it do?
I don't know its opening weekend, but its budget was a very big $132 million because it's big. A Spielberg, big action film. Box office was just a meager $604 million.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty insane. Like, yeah. It made a lot of money, this movie. Like, the assertion that that this ruined his chances at making a lot of money is probably pretty wide of the base. And the reviews were, like, positive, too, praising Cruise's performance, and especially Spielberg's directing and use of special effects. I think critics also pointed out that they liked it was dark and seemed to have more to say than your usual sort of blockbuster spectacle. And off the back of all of this, it became apparent that the relationship between Cruise and Spielberg was not good. Aside from trying to recruit him, amongst those recruitment discussions, which would have included discussions around prescription drugs, because that was certainly Tom Cruise's bugbear at the time, Spielberg mentioned the name of a doctor that had helped one of his friends of his with depression by prescribing drugs, and that doctor's office was then picketed by Scientologists. No doubt down to Cruise telling them who it was. And Spielberg also took issue with the fact that Cruise used what should have been a promotional tour for War of the Worlds as a promotional tour for, like, his weird crusade for his new relationship with Katie Holmes. It's been reported that Steven Spielberg felt it hurt the film and that he would not work with Tom Cruise again. A spokesperson for Cruise at the time said it was all fabricated and that they remained close friends and that they were in fact looking forward to working together again. And they never worked together again. And I really doubt that they will.
They're working together on the SpaceX project. Right, it's just, are they just actually? Had to wait. No, they're not. No.
Oh, okay.
Just
right.
Imagine if they just had to wait for the technology to catch up with them.
You know? It's not outside of the realms of possibility that he would be in something that Spielberg had produced, but I don't even think we've got that. But imagine if they had continued. What a dream team. What weird places would Spielberg have pushed Tom Cruise to? You know, imagine like if, you know, fucking Tom Cruise had been in Munich or something, you know? Like, I mean, that never would have happened. But
Bridge of Spies? Like, could have been a Bridge of Spies.
Yeah, imagine if he transitions to Cruise instead of Hanks, you know? It would have been really interesting, I think. But, you know, Cruise is a fucking weirdo and burned that bridge, I guess. Which kind of brings us to the end of this episode. Before we wrap up, though, it's obviously time for our long-running game. Only one of us is allowed to look at the IMDb trivia page for each movie, and this week it's me. I'm going to present Tom with three pieces of trivia. Only one of them is one that I've made up, and he'll have to discern which one that is in two Cruise and a lie. All right, so you're fully aware, Chris, that we started putting some some money on this.
Yeah.
I've gotten a little bit trapped in what can only be described as a double or nothing spiral. The last episode, I mean, I can't catch a break, really. Last episode, I owed you £163,840.
Yes.
Double or nothing?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. What would that actually be? Well, we'll figure out. I don't even need to figure out what it would be because I'm pretty certain I have got this one, right? Because I've been focusing on what you do when you win these, okay? When you're in charge of the facts, okay? And I know what you do. You take a fact that already exists and change one little detail about it to try and trick me, okay? Sure. And that's what I'm, you know, maybe that's what I've done this time around, okay? So,
okay.
Number one. Bill Murray was the original choice for Ogilvy, but scheduling with the Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou prevented him from accepting the role.
Okay.
Maybe I've changed one of the little details of that.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Like the name.
Yeah. Number two. Steven Spielberg began filming Munich the day this film opened and still released it in the same year.
He did have half a year left to do it, so.
Well, yeah, but you know, maybe I've changed it's impressive, one little detail. Maybe it's a different film or something, yeah. Number three. While filming nearby, Tom Cruise, along with a 20-member entourage, including Steven Spielberg, visited a Virginia Dairy Queen. Cruise saw a jar on the counter with a photo of Ashley Flint and her story. Flint had been in a go-kart accident a few months earlier, leaving her family with a mountain of hospital bills. Cruise stole $5,000 in cash from the jar. And maybe I've just changed one little detail or word or something, and you'll never know which one it is.
Yeah.
What do you reckon? Confer with Chris, please.
Yeah. I mean, Chris, what do you think? Do you reckon Spielberg could create Munich in half a year?
I mean, I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it?
If it had come out of anyone other than Adam's mouth, I would say bullshit.
Yeah. Remind me of the first one.
Bill Murray was the original choice for Ogilvy, but scheduling with The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and maybe that's the detail I've changed, prevented him from accepting.
Yeah, I think it was Bill Murray, but he didn't do it because he hates Steven Spielberg. That's really the reason, and that's the thing that Adam's changed.
Yeah.
What do you reckon, Tom?
I reckon that through a series of dodgy double or nothing bets, Tom Cruise was in dire financial straits during the production of War of the Worlds, a film that grossed over $500 million in 2005. So, Adam, I think that he has the cold, uncaring eyes of a man who would steal $5,000 from a woman who desperately needs it. So I'm going to go with number three for the lie.
But you've just said that you do think he would steal money from it.
I really thought he was gonna bait and switch at the end.
The thing is, right, I've
got my hopes up.
I've known Tom for a long time, as I know you have, Adam. And I know that Tom could never bring himself, even as a joke, not to win a game.
Well, no, this is desperately serious. There's absolutely no jokes involved in Two Crews and a Lie.
Yeah.
And anyone who asserts that there is simply wrong. Simply wrong. That is correct, Tom. So that's very annoying.
How much do you owe me now?
£327,680.
Wow. That's good, isn't it?
I've not got it, to be honest with you.
You can pay me back over a period of years.
How long a period of years?
The rest of your life.
Okay, cool. I mean, what would that work out to? Oh, we'll figure it out, because I think next week I'm gonna draw the stake clean, I think. Double or nothing next week?
Of course.
Okay, great. Well, that is how and why we play Two Crews and a Lie. I did just change one little thing that Tom Cruise actually just did put $5,000 in cash into the jar. Imagine walking around with $5,000 in cash.
Again, he is a maniac. It's a very nice thing to do, but also, like, everything he does, even when he does nice things, it's like through the prism of the fact that he's a maniac, isn't it?
Also, it's just a jar.
Yeah.
He just put $5,000 in a jar that was on a counter of a Dairy Queen. What an insane man. Chris, where do we find you and your podcast and other things that you do and work on and believe in?
So you can find me at the main place you can find me really is on my podcast, as you mentioned, which is called How to Survive. It's about horror movies and how we would survive in them. We cover a different horror movie every week. So at the moment, I think we've just started up the podcast again. And I assume if this podcast isn't going out for a couple of weeks, then you should be able to find a couple of episodes that have been released recently, including Jordan Peele's Nope and Ty West's X. And you can find us there. It's called How to Survive. We've covered about 250 different films. We're also on Patreon, wow. patreon.com/howtosurvivepod. You can find us on Twitter at howtosurvivepod. And yeah, we'll look forward to seeing you over there.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much for doing this, Chris.
It's been
really
a pleasure.
Fun. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Come and let us know what you think of the movie. Twitter and Instagram, Cruise Views Pod. Email us in some longer thoughts, and eventually I will not run out of time like I do every week, and I will read out some of the emails that we receive. cruiseviewspodcast@gmail.com. Also, find us on Letterboxd. We're both on Letterboxd. It's a fun time. You get a little sneak previews of what we think of each movie, including my increasingly desperate attempts to link it to our podcast. But until then, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to watch Mission Impossible 3 before next week's episode. This podcast will self-destruct in 5 seconds.